Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon, and we're the Old Dogs.
If you've got about 20 minutes, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the Old Dogs ramble about what happens if we outlive our partner. We introduce a new retail concept, alcoholic ice cream. We challenge you with another What Year Was It? We mark the loss of a grade school favorite, the number two pencil. We bring you another installment from our chief aging officer. And we share some tips on traveling light. The Old Dog's Conversation is a memoir of small-town life shared between Paul and our former guest, Michael Schaefer. Stay with us. Well there, Paul.
Hey there.
I'm wondering what's on your mind today.
What's on my mind, Jim, is something that we have done several pieces on in the past.
Oh, no.
And it's about the fact that a couple, a married couple, the odds are there will be a survivor. But I thought maybe in a whim of fantasy, why don't we think about you and I surviving our spouse?
Yeah.
And you think we could actually live on our own? What do you think?
Are you talking about like moving in with me? And
no, I'm talking about living by yourself.
All right. I got to tell you, living alone would certainly have its challenges when you have been with a person that you really enjoy being with. But I think that there's also enjoyment in being alone. For one thing, I can choose to do what I want to do when I want to do it. I don't have to check another schedule. I don't have to decide when we're going to have to plan to do something. I can be more spontaneous. So there is a certain advantage to doing that, especially if I want to get up and take a walk or drive over to a park or something, feed the ravens and crows.
Would you have ravens in your park?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That could work if you do those things, if you do force yourself to keep engaged with life.
Right.
But I think a lot of people our age, when they find themselves alone, they just kind of give up.
Look, there's also something that is fundamental to this podcast. That's the reason why we started this.
Would that be me?
You thought of it. But the idea that you can start something new later in life, and that would certainly be a benefit if you were doing it, if you were living alone, the fact that you had started a new career, whether it's as a photographer or as a naturist, bird watcher or something, whatever it happens to be, a heart surgeon,
That's what I'm going for. Well, yeah. It doesn't have to be a new career. It can simply be a hobby that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever that might be, whittling matchsticks or, you know, making model planes. If you find something that gives you pleasure, I think that can take an edge off living alone.
Sure. All right. So
what are you serving for lunch today? All this talk made me hungry, Jim. The Washington Post informed us of a new franchise in the D.C. area that can best be described as an ice cream shop for adults. The store is called Tipsy Scoop, and it offers up desserts that are, intoxicating.
There are 8 flavors of spiked ice cream, including Tequila Sunrise Sundae, Cherry Blossom Old Fashioned, Cake Batter Vodka Martini, Spiked Mint Chocolate Chip, and Vanilla Bean Bourbon.
I think I'll go with a Cake Batter Vodka. You can also order ice cream cocktails that resemble a root beer float, but with your favorite liquor instead of root beer. You can also get regular cocktails, but then why come to Tipsy Scoop for a simple cocktail that you can get cheaper at your local bar?
Yeah. Tipsy Scoop seems like someone was trying too hard to come up with a franchise concept. But if you're interested in a dessert that attacks both your pancreas and your liver, give it a try. Just don't forget to bring along a designated driver. Well, I might get in line for that.
Okay, the line extends from Washington, D.C. to Houston, huh?
Kathleen O'Brien is our chief aging officer and the author of Reclaim Your Right to Grow Old. From time to time, she has contributed her observations on the joys and challenges of growing old. This is her 18th installment.
I just flew in from Miami, and no, my arms aren't tired, but my eyes got a workout, not from sun reflecting off the water, but from the lack of any kind of clothing on almost everyone. Young people, the middle-aged, old folks. It's as if people had just given up on finding anything to cover themselves with and decided to walk around without a care in the world, or their pants, or a top, or even what used to pass for a bathing suit. Portly guys, I'm being kind here, in miniature Speedos with a lifetime of overindulging in beer and a belly to prove it, hanging, sorry, around the pool. Women with décolleté down to there, falling out of way too small bandeau tops and thongs that do a disservice to the subject. But I digress. Even thin young things looked as if they stepped out of the shower and bypassed any semblance of a closet. One young woman on South Beach, in the town, not on the beach, was wearing a square piece of material about the size of a neck scarf in the front and another one on the back with a string around her middle. What was underneath? Not one blessed thing. And where was she going? Grocery shopping at Winn-Dixie. Okay, I've had my fling with skimpy outfits. When hot pants first came out, you know, little shorts you wore with tights and boots in the early 70s, I bought a pair in suede and wore them to opening night at a play. But when intermission came, I realized I was the only one in the audience wearing this new fashion trend. I kept my coat on. In case you're wondering, I do wear bathing attire at my age. Hey, 80-year-old guys, check me out. And if you squint and it's nighttime, whoa, look out, boys. But I'm just saying, when it's time to cover up, it is. Where's a fig leaf when you need it?
Our trivia challenge for this episode is, what year was it? We'll give you selected events from the year, and you guess what year it was.
During this year, the top song was You Light Up My Life, sung by Debbie Boone.
The movie to watch was Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope.
Notable books included The Thorn Birds and Oliver's Story.
Time Magazine's Man of the Year was Anwar Sadat.
The Son of Sam serial killer David Berkowitz was finally captured.
SlimFast began selling as a weight loss product.
Elvis Presley died at the age of 42.
The U.S. returns the Panama Canal back to Panama.
And Apple Computer was incorporated by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak.
Got it yet? Here's one more clue. The movie Saturday Night Fever opens, popularizing or perhaps inflicting disco dancing on the world.
Yes, the year was 1977. If you went disco dancing, the idea was to look good under the mirror ball, which meant lots of color and polyester for both sexes. We boomers used to practice taking the SAT in order to get into a good college, or any college for that matter, and if we were really well prepared, we would show up on test day with a fistful of number two pencils just in case.
Well, according to the New York Times, the number two pencil, essential for filling in the test answer boxes, has gone the way of the dodo bird. The SAT has gone fully digital, and some say less rigorous.
This year's version of the SAT has been designed to reduce stress, according to College Board, which administers the test. The need for change was partly motivated by many colleges eliminating standardized testing as an entrance requirement.
The test is now briefer by 45 minutes, as well as allowing more time for answering each question. The reading passages are much shorter for those frustrating reading comprehension questions. And the final concession, students can use an online graphing calculator for the entire math section.
Now, supporters of the changes say that students with learning disabilities are now better able to maintain their focus, while critics say the College Board is trying to cater to the shorter attention spans of students getting their information from the Internet.
Whether you are for or against these changes, standardized testing remains the best predictor of college success. Plus, the electronic version reduces the possibility of cheating.
Yeah, but we still tell our grandkids we had to climb uphill in snow with a fistful of number two pencils to take the SAT.
Yes, certainly.
Most folks have a problem with packing too much stuff for a trip. As a result, they drag an overstuffed suitcase to the scales at the airline counter, fearing the worst. Well, the Discoverer blog recommends some things you can leave behind.
Let's start with shampoo, soap, and other toiletries. You can easily find these items at your destination and then leave them behind on your departure.
Neck pillows are one of those things that seem like a good idea, but they're never actually comfortable to use or carry.
True.
Most longer flights can provide a small pillow or just make do by rolling up your jacket or sweater.
Here's something that can save a lot of room. Don't pack up workout clothes and running shoes. You know darn well that you never have and never will work out while on vacation.
Those heavy guidebooks that you never read at home will not be read on your trip. The same goes for recreational reading. If you must take books along, put them on your phone or Kindle.
And finally, get realistic about how many outfits you need. Clothes can be washed as you travel. A little inconvenience spent cleaning will be balanced by a lighter suitcase. It's a vacation, not a fashion show.
Yeah, Jim, and maybe not worry about the cleaning even.
Two episodes ago, we interviewed Michael Schaefer about his career as a surgeon and his current focus on wood sculpture. During that conversation, he told us a story about a tragic accident that affected his community as he was growing up. The story captured small-town life so well, we decided to feature it in this episode. We set up the story by asking Michael and Paul to share their memories about growing up in a small town.
We have two different small towns that we grew up in. They were both small communities. His was a farming community. Mine was a mining community, iron ore mining. And so I thought it'd be kind of interesting to chat with Michael about how our experiences were similar and how they were different.
Well, I suspect that that the similarities probably outweigh the differences. The differences are in geography and maybe the obvious things of yours was mining and mine was basically wheat farming at that point in my life, or at that point in history. Western Kansas was a wheat farming place. And my dad was in the grain business, and the whole town depended upon the farming community. If the farmers did well, the car dealers did well, and the grocery stores did well. And if they didn't, then everybody kind of suffered. So, it was definitely a small town, which I didn't realize at the time how small it was. I thought it was kind of the center of the universe.
Yeah.
We called my town the Golden Buckle of the Wheat Belt.
Okay. Well, my experience in a mining town was the economy came and went with the price of steel. if steel was in demand, and fortunately we had kind of a consistent world war going on all during my growing up, so there was a demand for steel. But everything flowed from how well the iron ore mines were doing. You had to make do with sort of one of everything, and I think you could probably resonate to that, Michael. There was one movie theater. There were a limited number of doctors available who you knew all of them on a first name basis. And small town life really kind of focused on a group of relatives that you frequently visited with each other, and it always involved potato salad.
Yeah. au contraire, we had two movie theaters. One was a walk-in and one was a drive-in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the drive-in was, of course, the make-out movie theater in the summer, only open in the summer, of course. They closed the walk-in in the summer so the drive-in could get the business. And then in the winter, it moved over to the walk-in theater, where every birthday party from about when I was 6 years old till late years in high school was what was called a line party to the show. So everybody would go to the birthday boy or girl, and their mother would then drive them down to the theater for the movie. That would be the main part of a birthday. After the ice cream and cake, of course, we would go see a movie.
For me, a drive-in was the A&W.
Oh.
And if you want a really good treat, like a root beer float, you would go across the street to the Dairy Queen, and then you could merge the two together.
Growing up, I went to every Saturday afternoon movie at the walk-in, which was always a Western, a comedy, and then the newsreel that let you know what was going on across the world. And really, there was not much news transmitted between one Saturday to the next on the newsreels. It was a way for us to keep up with world events.
In terms of shopping, our small town had two options. You could go to the JCPenney or the Montgomery Ward if you needed to buy sundries. And groceries, pretty much there was one grocery store. In our hometown, it was the Piggly Wiggly.
We had a Ben Franklin store and a Duckwall store for, you know, ordinary household goods. We had three drug stores, and there were patrons of those drug stores. You very seldom went to a drug store where you really weren't accustomed to being there.
And of course, everybody knew you by name, or you knew them by name.
Of course.
It's not a group of strangers. And we did have a radio station. Did you have a radio station?
We did, but it came later, not while I was growing up there. It came about the time I went away to college. We got a radio station in our little town.
And it was kind of the social information center for our community. It would tell you what's going on, where the picnics are, where this is happening, where that is happening.
Well, we had a regional radio station in Colby, Kansas. It's called KXXX, the Voice of the High Plains, and it broadcast all over the northwest quarter of Kansas. They had a wide range, but for many years, that was the only radio station within, 150 miles.
In retrospect, I think growing up in a small town felt safe. It felt connecting and supportive. But once I left the town, I had no desire to go back. How about you?
Oh, I felt the same way, Paul. I knew from early on that I couldn't stay there. It really was a wonderful place to grow up. You probably can identify with this, of playing kick the can and riding your bike all over town and learning to ride with no hands because there wasn't much traffic, no hands on your bike.
Did you put playing cards in the spokes of your bike so it sounded like a motor scooter or motorbike?
I didn't. I thought that was really gauche.
That was me. I was gauche. Well, Michael, I think we should switch over then to the story you shared with us. And I guess the apt title for this would be Tragedy in a Small Town.
Okay. It began as an ordinary day in my hometown, Norton, Kansas, a little town of 4,000 people on the edge of the prairie, where time stands still and not much changes from one generation to the next. It's a town where a restaurant is judged by the number of different kinds of jello salad at the salad bar, and appetizers at a successful dinner party are cubes of minced ham and Velveeta cheese skewered on a toothpick, or swirls of cheese whiz on a Ritz cracker with a slice of pimento olive on top. It's a bustling little town with good schools and good athletic teams. It's mostly a happy little town. That is, it was a happy town till tragedy struck one day. Tragedy the likes of which the people there had never experienced before.
that shook the town of Norton to its very core. 3 men died that day in a grain elevator accident. Gene Schaefer, my dad, and Paul Stutterheim have been partners down at the Ralph Rich Grain Company for almost 35 years. They had both retired and had turned the management of this country elevator and grain business over to Paul's son, Don Stutterheim. However, both Paul Stutterheim and Gene Schaefer continued to come down to the elevator almost every day, mostly because they just couldn't quite let go. They couldn't stop what they had been doing for all of those years. But they also came down to just sit and chat with the old customers, and they wanted to make sure everything was going well. Leo Dirks had been in that morning to settle up for his wheat harvest, and Tom Melroy was just pulling out in his big rig with a load of rolled oats and molasses to feed his cattle. In fact, Tom had gotten the last of the molasses stored in the pit, where it was kept to be mixed with the grain as it tumbled down the chute and was augured up into the waiting truck. Don Stutterheim was out in the driveway of the elevator that morning, making his rounds to see that everything was working as it should. The 3 workmen were all doing various chores around the place. Harold Wiltfall had been there the longest, probably 20, 25 years, and was the senior man of the group, and also the one who could talk the most and for the longest, while leaning up against the customer's pickup truck or car, all the while with a toothpick or a wooden matchstick dangling from the corner of his mouth. Darrell Keyswetter and Phil Pogue had each worked there for 10 or 12 years, and each knew his way around the place. They were the best of friends. After the last load of rolled oats and molasses was finished, Phil Pogue looked down into the molasses pit, saw that it was completely empty. He decided to go down into the pit and sweep it all out before pouring in the next batch of that sticky, sweet-smelling black-brown liquid that the livestock loved so much and made them eat more grain to fatten them up for the market. Phil grabbed the broom and climbed down the iron-rungs ladder into the depths of that molasses pit. Several minutes went by, and Darrell Keyswetter realized he had not heard a sound from that pit since Phil climbed down into it. He looked down and saw his friend slumped over, motionless on the floor. Without thinking, he then slid down the ladder to help his friend. He did not come back up either. Don Stutterheim was nearby and must have sensed that something was wrong. Both men had disappeared and there was no sound to be heard. Don looked into the hole and realized what was happening. He saw his men lying on the floor. He gave a blood-curdling cry for help, slid down the ladder, and tried to rescue his men. He didn't come back up either. The volunteer fire department was called, and they came with their oxygen tanks and went down into that pit and hauled out the 3 men, one by one. All those men were known by everybody in town, and especially Don Stutterheim. He was young and had a family, and he truly was loved by everybody in town. He had died a hero's death, for he surely knew what was going on, and even so plunged down that hole to rescue his men. These men had not died from a toxic gas, but from an absolute total absence of oxygen, which is causes death within seconds, but nobody thought about that at the time. The volume of liquid matter that had been in there had forced all the air out of the space, and when it drained, the only air hole was a small manhole at the top, and consequently, there had been no replenishing of the oxygen into that space. In an atmosphere totally devoid of oxygen, a man can live only a split second and then dies immediately. These men had died such a death, painless, but awful and sad nonetheless. The following Saturday, there were 3 funerals in Norton, 2 at the Enfield Funeral Home and 1 at the Methodist Church. Pretty much everybody in the county attended them all, and pretty much the same things were said at each of them. Pretty much the same songs were sung, including The Old Rugged Cross and Amazing Grace. And pretty much everybody cried. By the end of that day, there was not a tear left in my hometown, Norton, Kansas.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.